All right, so I'm going to kick off. My name is Adam Hall. I sit inside the Windows Server product group in Redmond. So I have the pleasure of owning the access and information protection scenarios all up. So I look after Active Directory, ADFS, rights management, dynamic access control, direct access, all the VPN networking stuff. And I also own all of the new features that have come through for the bring your own desktop scenario or bring your own device scenarios in Windows Server 2012 R2. So the people-centric IT demo that you saw in the keynote this morning that Molly did, was my demo. She delivered it for us and did a great job. And what I want to do in this session is take a look at the breadth of solutions that come together to enable us to do that demo. We're going to cover at a very sort of quasi-deep level, it's just a 200-level session, all of the different technologies that are in R2 that enable us to do the workplace join, device registration, publishing out things out through the web application proxy. We're going to take a look at work folders for synchronizing information, take a look at the new ADFS, which is greatly enhanced from the one that we previously had, and go through how this all comes together and help you understand all the different things that come together to enable people to work on devices of their choice and be able to work from anywhere and get access to all those corporate resources whilst we give IT some semblance of control in how those do it. So how we do that. So the first thing, and for those of you who were in the foundation session, you would have seen these first two slides before, but just for context, when we think about what we're trying to do here, we're looking at this change in expectation that users have to be able to work on any device. And as Molly's opening phrase was in the keynote, this isn't just sort of some trend that's going on and some aspirational statement. It's actually what we're seeing in customers now, and it's the challenges that have been faced. And they want to work in any location and have access to all their resources. College grads are coming into the workplace, and they have an expectation that they can bring their device in and get their job done. It's not something that they're saying, hey, can I? They are just doing it, okay? And whether you realize it's happening in your environment or not, the most likely scenario is that there are non-corporate devices accessing your resources, whether you're aware of it or not. And this is something that users are just doing and expecting to be able to do. The explosion of devices that we see, all the iPads, the Androids, the Windows RTs, all these non-corporate devices, there's just a sheer explosion in terms of the availability of these devices, the power that they actually have, and quite frankly, they're really nice devices to use. They are much more easier to consume information on compared to the sort of the beige corporate PC. And we've moved beyond this sort of capability we used to have where you come into work, you get your work done at the desk, you walk away from the desk and you're done with work. It doesn't happen anymore. We're blending our personal and work worlds and everything from email on your device all the way through to VPN connections and remote desktops. People are working on their device, and what this means is that we've seen an erosion of what you would consider a standard device. There is no standard. If you're lucky, you can have a standard image that goes on your PCs. That's not going to go onto your phones. That's not going to go onto your iPads. That's not going to go on anywhere. You need to look to control these things and enable people to work that way. Bring apps into that. Now we've got three major platforms, at least four if you count BlackBerry. And the ability to get apps onto those devices, developers only developing apps for some of those platforms. Then you've got PCs, and then you've got RT and x86 and all these different things coming through. How do you get apps onto all of those devices in a nice, easy way and still let people get their jobs done across all those platforms? And then you bring data into that, and all hell breaks loose, because now you've got corporate data in SkyDrive, corporate data in Dropbox, corporate data on C drives, on USB drives, on phones. What happens when these devices get stolen or lost or someone just leaves the organization? If I am fired, if I leave an organization, my company wants to know that I don't have access to stuff that I shouldn't have access to anymore. And how do you do that? If you let them put data on that device, you've lost control. And they can leave the organization and take it with them, and there's nothing you can do about it. So what's our approach to this? We've got management coming through around users, devices, applications, and data, and the three sort of core pillars there around management, access control, and then protection of that information as well. And we sort of bring these together in three ways. We want to be able to enable your end users to work on that device in the way that they choose. So we want to make sure that they get consistent access to their resources and that they are able to get their jobs done. We want to unify your environment, and when we think about access and information protection, this is in two ways. You've got the unification of the management console, so that's sort of configuration manager with Windows Intune embedded into it, but also hybrid identity and bringing in the ability to have a single user log on across all resources, whether they're on-premises, whether they're in the cloud, whether they're hybrid, whether they're in a SaaS app, Salesforce.com, and all those other things that are out there that you guys are consuming. How do you give users a single log on and be able to control that? And then being able to protect that data. And we had dynamic access control and rights management in 2012. In R2, we've got some new capabilities come through, as well as some additional Windows Azure capabilities that I'll talk about a little bit as well. So that's just a little bit of a setup. Now, thinking specifically about access and information protection, there's a few scenarios that are coming through here. And this is not a complete bucket list, but it is the main areas that we're thinking about. The first one is the simplified registration and enrollment. And I'm going to go through the difference between registration and enrollment. Molly showed workplace join and doing the multi-factor authentication there, and then she enrolled the device. Technologically, they're quite different. They may look similar on the surface, so I'm going to explain what the difference is between those two things. The automatic connection to internal resources, so in Windows 8.1, in conjunction with Server 2012 R2, we have the ability to do automatic VPNs. So when you launch that line of business application that needs to talk to a database that's on-premises, when you launch the app, it will trigger the VPN on the user's behalf. Now, in 2012 R2, this is still a system-level VPN, but we are looking at that at an application level moving forward as well. And then access to company resources across all the devices. I'm going to go through the web application proxy, which is a new capability in R2, running in the RAS role, and how we make it really easy to publish these resources out to users so they can securely get access to it and be authenticated at the edge. From a unification of the environment, the common identity, talking about Windows Azure Active Directory as well as Windows Server Active Directory and what the relationship is between those two things, and then protecting the data. The existing corporate information protection that we have in market, as well as the policy-based access to control that we can now do with some of the R2 functionality as well. So there's a little bit of a blend here of 2012 and R2. I'm going to be focusing pretty much solely in this session on new capabilities in Server 2012 R2. Okay, so unless I say otherwise, these are all R2 capabilities that have a requirement for R2 servers. I'll highlight where there are schema changes required for Active Directory and where there are specific requirements required at a version control level as well. Okay, so empowering users. What are the challenges we're trying to solve here? The first one is being able to get users onto those devices, and how do they get access to those resources? We talked about that a little bit. Access to corporate resources as well from anywhere, and how do they access those, and then being able to control that information. These are the problems that we're trying to solve in this particular statement. So registering a device makes it known to IT, puts a record in Active Directory. It is a new device object that we'll talk about, and it effectively takes a mapping of the device and some metadata that we collect about the device, the user who registered that device, and it puts a certificate onto the device that creates two ends of the spectrum that we can then communicate between. Enrolling the device, which is joining to the Windows Azure cloud-based management service, and then publishing of the corporate resources. Okay, so let's go through this a little bit more. And you can see lots of diagrams here. I'm going to break it up with some demo as well and break out and show you what I can. There are some network connectivity challenges that we're having, so I will demo as much as I possibly can. I may or may not be able to do the form factor demo because my cellular reception's a bit dodgy in here. So, working from anywhere. The first thing is the registration of the device into Active Directory. This is called Workplace Join. It will be known as Workplace Join on both Windows 8.1 and iOS. So it works across 8.1 clients. It's in the Charms network workplace settings. In iOS, it's a website, and you can send a URL to your users. And basically, you enter your UPN. It's positioned to the customer or to your end users as their email address. In reality, it is their UPN. Okay, so whatever their UPN is what they need to enter here in order to be able to register. They may or may not be prompted for multi-factor authentication, something like phone factor, RSA, whatever multi-factor authentication that you use. When we enroll the device, we're talking to Windows Intune, and you would have seen the company portal that comes down. That company portal is not baked into 8.1. That is an application that you install after enrollment. Okay, it's one question that came up. post the keynote in the foundation session. The company portal is not baked into 8.1. You go to the Windows Marketplace, you install the company portal, and then you can go through and get the apps and so on. It is just a simple, I think it's like a meg and a half download, install, and then you get it. Remote access, we still have direct access. There are no additional capabilities in direct access in Server 2012 R2. Okay, what you have in 2012 is what you have in R2. There's no additional capabilities there. And then the automatic VPN connections, being able to terminate those, as we talked about. The web application proxy is a new functionality that is in the RAS role. So the web app proxy is a new service role within remote routing and remote access. And it enables us to publish resources. It can do straight pass-through publishing, as in, hey, it's over there, NTLM, kind of basic authentication. Or if you've got claims-aware applications, you can put it through ADFS and do all sorts of conditional access and put policies around that, around whether your device must be registered before you can get access to the device, what sorts of multi-factor authentications kick in, and any kind of regulations about network location in or outside the network before you can access that information. And then we have the standard remote desktop RDS, VDI kind of gateways. And there are some enhancements in that that there are other sessions on. Pretty much they are all around reconnecting speed, getting that reconnecting RDS dialogue that can take up to a minute to reconnect. I think it's down to like 8 seconds or something in the preview, and hopefully it will be faster moving forward again, as well as some additional UI elements around rendering correctly on native clients as well. So that's just a little bit of a setup. You can ask questions on the way through. If we get too rat-holed, I'll park them for the end, but there's enough time for a few questions on the way through.
So how does the web application proxy compare to UAG?
It's a great question. So the question was, how does the web application proxy compare to UAG? The web application proxy, as you will see, is all about publishing access to resources internally. It is publishing web applications in R2. Okay, so it's about publishing websites or web-enabled claims-aware applications. It's got a very specific BYOD flavor to it. UAG is still in market. We've released SP3. SP4 comes out towards the end of this year to bring additional platform support and continues to move forward in its current state. So it's still supported until the end of 2015, blah, blah, blah. Okay. The web application proxy is not designed to replace UAG in this release. It's designed to enable new scenarios that were not capable to be put into the existing UAG base. There's no further roadmap information on UAG at that point. But good question, and a fair question too. So let's think about this. Registering your device also gives you single sign-on. And the way this is achieved is the device itself becomes a second factor of authentication. We now know who you are because you entered your credentials. We also know the device that you're on and the certificate that's on that device with a record and AD. We are authenticating you twice. If you so choose, you can turn on single sign-on with that, which means that we use longer duration cookies and you can enforce multi-factor authentication. And effectively, from a user point of view, as they sign on to resources, we cache those for a really long period of time and you can trigger what that re-authentication looks like. So the user gets a seamless sign-on that uses, and from an IT perspective, it gets the user and the device. So it's effectively a two-factor authentication going on there. Now, interesting, the device registration is per user, okay, which is important because, A, from a user point of view, if you've got people sharing a device, they each need to register it. But second of all, from an IT point of view, if that device hits your network and a different user is logged on, it won't work. It's the combination of the user and the device, okay, which is where the two-factor comes in. As we talked about, there's a new device object in Active Directory, so there is a schema change required. It increments the schema change moves up to 67 or 69, I think, something like that, in 2012, and you can apply the schema change as far back as 2003 R2, I believe. 2008 is recommended, obviously, because 2003 is out of support, but it will work as far back as 2003 R2. That mechanism actually requires, and I use the word requires quite forcefully here, ADFS and the web application proxy in order to register your device. Regardless of whether they are coming internal or external, you require at least ADFS and the web application proxy. The reason for that is ADFS has been re-architected and updated, and you should think of ADFS and the web application proxy as being extensions of Active Directory capability now. Okay? ADFS is bringing in the ability to do claims-aware authentication and conditional access, leveraging Active Directory identity, and then published out through the web application proxy. The web application proxy also does authentication at the edge. So when you are doing that multi-factor authentication, you can see Windows Azure Active Authentication up there, which is the new name for the phone factor acquisition that we made. The web application proxy is actually doing that authentication at the edge. It's a pre-auth of the user and the device. And that multi-factor authentication happens before it even gets to the internal network. Okay, so all of this is happening at the edge and pre-auth before you come through. Those two questions, I think you were first. So the question is, will this work with the current version of ADFS? No. This is an update to ADFS. And you believe me, when you see the interface and you see how it works, you want the new one anyway because the old one was kind of horrible. Fair question. There's one down the back. Sorry, I couldn't quite hear you. Windows Azure is not required in this scenario. And in fact, the device registration is on-premises in Windows Server Active Directory only at this stage. Windows Azure Active Directory down the line a little bit. I don't know their disclosure, so I won't say when, but it is coming. Yeah.
Is it a brand new object class?
It is a brand new object class. This does not exist. The schema change brings in the new object classes. Okay, it's a device object. Now, when you enroll your devices, we talked about this in the Windows Intune Cloud, that goes across to Configuration Manager for those of you that are desktop admins in here. Hopefully you've seen that demo before. But basically, in Configuration Manager, Windows Intune shows up as a site server role. You can just deploy there as it is. All non-domain joined machines we are recommending to be managed with Windows Intune. Intune is designed to manage non-domain joined machines. Configuration Manager is designed to manage domain joined machines. So using them for the best purpose is there. They are tightly connected. All the information goes backwards and forwards and so on. It's the recommended way of doing that. So let's take a look at workplace join and see what that actually looks like. Now hopefully my network connection is holding up. Okay, so I have on here, this is a Windows 8.1 client, and I do apologize, there's gonna be a little bit of lag in this. And if I navigate, and this is sitting on an external network, okay? It is not connected to my domain. It is sitting outside the web application proxy. You can see I'm on an unified network. I really am on an isolated network. We go into change PC settings and navigate through the new modern control panel to workplace. And I'm prompted here for my user ID. This is the UPN of the user who is connecting. So I am actually going to play Brad today, because I can, and I'm going to click the join button. Now what this is doing, it is now communicating, it's done a DNS record lookup, and it's looking for a URL called enterpriseregistration.yourdomainname. Okay? It is a hard-coded URL that you need to put a DNS record out there so it can get to it. You also need to have your ADFS published so you know where your STS actually is, whatever the name of your ADS farm is. So that is where it's talking to. Now, if I was connected with phone factor, which I am not in this environment, at this point in time when I authenticated, it would do the phone call like Molly did. This environment is only connected to my domain without the multi-factor authentication. So we're going to log on as Brad and sign in. And quite literally, that is it. It is a very, very simple thing to do. What is happening behind the scenes, I'm going to show you in the next couple of demos when I get to web application proxy and to ADFS, and I'll show you how this is actually configured. Now, I've got this deliberately hard-coded just so I can show you. If I go to them. All right, let's go to Windows. System32. I've got this in a host file, so I can show you what it looks like. Okay, so these are You can see I've hard-coded it to 8888, which is the external IP address of my web application proxy. This is running completely isolated. And I've got a record for contoso.com, which is my domain, because it's going to want to know where Contoso actually is. ADFS.contoso.com is the name of my ADFS farm. Enterprise registration, .contoso.com is the hard-coded requirement. You must use that URL. All these other URLs are configurable by you. That one is not. Okay, and you need an internal record, and you need an external record. Expenses.contoso.com is a website that I have access to, and sts.contoso.com is there. So just to show you, actually, I should have done this back the other way. I kind of did it backwards, but I'll show you what it looks like. Let's go back to here. Let's leave that. Let's go to... Now, if I've configured this right, it should deny me access. Oh, it's going to want ADFS. I've just configured it. So this is where if I turned on, and I have not turned it on, device registration requirement, this is where it would say, thanks for coming in, but you're not allowed to join until you get your device registered, which is what I only did in the demo. At this point in time, it would ask me to register. I would go back and do that. The mechanism that's doing that is ADFS. As you can see, I'm getting prompted for ADFS again. When I click sign in and it's there, it's going to come up. I've just got a simple who am I app there showing you the claims that I've passed through. You can see that we have a SAML token coming back, as well as some information about the authentication. So I'll go through in a little bit more detail the details behind that when we get to the web application proxy and to ADFS, which is coming up right now. So, web application proxy, and this will give you some more details about what we're actually doing here. So, accessing those applications and data, the web application proxy is what is doing that authentication. It is hitting the web app proxy until I successfully device registered and passed my credentials. I was stopping at the external address of the web application proxy. That's as far as I could go. Once I get through, and it's then proxying that information across to ADFS, which is going across to Active Directory. That's the path of the way we get there. Now, the web app proxy can do reverse proxy to IntelM and basic apps only. So if you just need to publish a website and it's just using standard credentials or basic authentication, you can use reverse proxy and just publish that straight out. Great, no problem. If you have a claims-aware application, and as you can see, that specifically we talk about the claims and Kerberos-aware web apps, we've got the Office Forms-based access, and also the RESTful OAuth apps. So if you look at that, the details you've got there, and compare it to what UAG does, and coming back to that question, there's no publishing of Exchange here, there's no publishing of Link here. We can do SharePoint if you turn on claims-aware. Okay, so the web app proxy is designed to do very specific web application publishing, hence its name. At the web application proxy, we can then go out to Windows Azure AD, answering the question before. This is where the single identity kicks in, where if you are coming in from Office 365 or if you're starting to access either a Windows Azure mobile service or looking out to a SaaS application like Salesforce, you could publish the access to Salesforce through the web application proxy, and when it hits ADFS, it'll go out to the SaaS app and present those credentials on the user's behalf. It's giving them a single sign-on to SaaS-based applications. Okay, which is kind of a challenge today, where you've typically got different credentials going backwards and forwards between the SaaS apps, between the other applications that are out there, and your on-premises Active Directory. We're building on what we've got in AD in terms of the identity realm that we have and enabling that to do additional things around conditional access, around these policies, and being able to go out to the cloud-based applications to take advantage of them. Sorry, can you repeat the question?
Another way of looking at it being a replacement for custom login pages on ADFS?
Is it a replacement for custom login pages? It depends what those custom login pages are doing. As you've seen from the interface, we're about taking the AD UPN username and password and configuring that with either smart tokens or two-factor authentication. If that's what you're doing with your custom app, then yes, that's a replacement. If you're doing something else, then you may still need that. But a lot of the custom pages are to get authentication to applications that are not easy to publish any other way. that. Absolutely. Question in the front. Either. So basically, the SharePoint site that, sorry, the question was publishing SharePoint, is it claims only, and is it Kerberos or is it SAML? It's actually both. So when you configure a SharePoint site, you can turn on Wear Apps or Wear Authentication, or you can make it claims only. And when you turn claims only, you can choose which way it does that. The way we had it running in the keynote, we've got it with SAML claims only. So that was ADFS taking a SAML token and passing it through ADFS out through the web application proxy backwards and forwards to the user with the additional requirement that the device be registered as well. Okay, hence Molly got declined on the way in because her username and password is not enough. Username, password, plus a certificate on the device, and then present those credentials through to the SAML app. That's basically what we're doing there. Okay. So let's take a look at the web application proxy, and I'm sure you're going to be totally underwhelmed by the interface because it's incredibly simple, which is kind of the point. Web application proxy. Okay, that's it. Exciting, huh? All right, so the web application proxy is really there. It simply publishes stuff. That's all that it does. And it is an incredibly simple, wizard-driven deployment where you choose at the first step, am I doing a claims-aware application that I want to point towards Active Directory Federation services, or am I simply doing pass-through and saying, hey, it's over there, have at it. Okay, that's it. When you do pass-through, as a matter of interest, you can do URL translation here. So you can have a different URL published to the internet pointing to a different address internal. So you might just have workfolders.contoso.com published external that points to server1.contoso.com internal. The web application proxy will do that URL translation for you on a site-by-site basis. When we do ADFS, we have a couple of additional settings required. The first thing that it does is it's integrated with the ADFS farm. It has now polled ADFS and pulled back the applications that I have configured in ADFS. Simply by going to ADFS and configuring an application for claims aware authentication and what the rules are, the web application proxy reads that and publishes it to the list and says, here you go, here's the apps that you've got available. What would you like to make available today? In this case, we've got that expenses application. We just click next. Again, we're prompted for what do we want to call it. We can call it TechEd. We can publish that as whatever we want, expenses one, because I've already got this one published, so I'll just do it again so you can see what it looks like. I can come down to here and say, actually, internally, that's just expenses. It's going to ask me for the certificate, so you need the certificate that you want to use when you're authenticating externally. I've got a wildcard. I do get a pop-up up here warning me that the internal and external URLs are being translated. This is not because the web application proxy can't do the translation. This is because some applications freak out when the header that comes through external doesn't match the header internal. If you haven't got all your hostname mappings working right and all of your bindings working okay, some web applications will freak out and not work. Okay, so be aware that you need to test your application, that URL translations are okay. If it translates okay, you're good to go. You click next, and it's just going to say, here it is. As always, we give you the PowerShell commandlet that you want to use, so you can automate this if you've got lots of them to do. And you hit finish, or publish, I should say, and it's going to run that script. It's going to freak out because I've already published it, which is fine. I will cancel that. And it turns up in that list. Simple as that. When you do pass-through, if we do a pass-through one, all that happens is you stop at the publishing settings, and that's all there is to it. What am I going to receive? Where am I going to send it to? That's all the web app proxy does, left to right, right to left, left to right. It doesn't care at that point in time what's going on. And that's about all there is to the web application proxy. I'm going to keep going because there's a lot of content I want to show you, and then we can do some questions at the end if you want. So, work folders. One person was in the room before this. Work folders we touched on in the keynote in the foundation session. So, work folders is about synchronizing data to devices. Think of it as Dropbox for the enterprise. Think of it as file server synchronization out to all your devices. You can configure a Server 2012 R2 file server as a work folder server, set up a sync share, which is a fancy way of saying a share that can be synchronized, and then you define which users can do it. That's basically it. Then on the client, you can either have it automatically populated through group policy, you can give a user a URL and they just type it in, whatever you want to do, manual or automatic. Once you do that, files synchronize backwards and forwards. At release, as in GA later this year, we'll have it running on 8.1 and most likely iOS. iOS may lag slightly after that. It all depends exactly how long it takes to get through the App Store and exactly when we finish that. We will also have Windows 7 followed by Android to come with that after it. Okay. So what we're enabling here is organizations to take file servers running on their premises or running up in EC2 or IaaS or where it is that you want to run it and synchronize that information to devices. Why is it important to enable this? We've got SkyDrive, we've got SkyDrive Pro. SkyDrive is consumer, and they do not want corporate data on SkyDrive. It's not what they want, it's not controlled, it's not able for corporations to do anything with. SkyDrive Pro is about SharePoint and taking SharePoint document libraries offline. This is about doing the same thing across file servers. And we know from our research and the data that we've got that file servers are growing at the same rate as everything else, if not faster, and so therefore having the ability to provide your users with their information locally on their devices, because not everyone's got Wi-Fi and high-speed broadband and lots of data caps and all that kind of stuff, being able to synchronize it out, but do it in a controlled way. You can enforce policy around whether the data is encrypted. If you do it through the company portal, it's then captured, and when you unenroll the device, you lose access to the files. Go back to that problem statement around how do you give people access to information, and when they lose the device or leave the company, say you don't have access to that data anymore. With work folders, all the data that hits a device is encrypted. When they leave or unenroll or that certificate chain is broken by an administrator or by the user performing that action, the data is no longer accessible because when you go to access the data, it phones home and says, have I got a token to access this? Okay, so there's a lot of control there. The way that this works, sorry, is there a question?
Yes, what happens if the device is not connected at that point?
So what happens when the device can't connect? It's not a connect every single time. It's a cache timeout that you can specify. So theoretically, yes, if someone stole a device and disconnected from the internet, or if they wiped it, then your problem's solved. If they managed to log on to the device as the user that was using it, so they'd need the user credentials in order to log on as them to the device or the PIN code for an iPad. If they never connected it to the internet ever again, they would be able to access that data. As soon as they access to the data, though, it's going to phone home and then lose the token and it'll be gone. And it's going to time out after a period of time because that token has a time frame on it. So if you were super paranoid, you could wind that right down or you could require it every time. Yeah, it's a good point. So it's a fair question. What's to stop someone taking that data and then moving it on? Absolutely nothing, just like any other data protection scenario, unless you protect the data itself, as in rights manage it, or some other encapsulating mechanism to prevent that, then you always have that problem. EFS lives on the device on which the data is. So you can EFS it on a survey, then you can EFS it again on the client. Someone puts that on a USB stick or emails it, absolutely. You can't stop a malicious act like that. Unless you rights management or some other technology of encrypting the data itself, and therefore then you've got a much more secure scenario. But it's the combination of all those layers together. We can't magically solve users doing things that they shouldn't do unless we add additional wrappers around the data itself. If you use Active Directory rights management, then even if they emailed the file, you still need credentials to open it regardless of who gets it. And that's where rights management online services kicks in, which is going to be an Azure-based service. It's been talked about this week. This is bringing rights management to all platforms in a cloud-based kind of service. So therefore, it's not just a Windows and Office scenario now. It's all platforms, all document types, emails, all those kinds of things. It's a subscribe service that is effectively coming in preview very shortly. Okay. The way this works is work folders can be published out either just through a straight firewall port mapping, it can be published out through a reverse proxy, or again, it can be published with the web app proxy and ADFS to do claims aware. And so depending on your level of paranoia and how hard you want to make it for that data to sync, you can do multi-factor authentication, you can do, force claims aware, you can tick the box that says the device must be registered, there's all these things you can do to make it harder for the user. You can also, through Windows Azure Active Author Phone Factor, enforce a multi-factor auth on a regular schedule. Sort of, you have to re-auth every week or every month or how often you want to do that. So the ability to have multi-factor auth, not just for the first sync, but for subsequent syncs on a schedule of your choosing as an administrator. So you can make that as difficult for users as you'd like. All of that is backed out to Active Directory. There's discoverability. If you do a schema change for AD for work folders, then you can turn on discoverability internally so all your clients magically find stuff. There is group policy management available so that you can pre-populate all this information and it just works. There you go, Christian. Whatever reverse proxy you want. It's just, it is just a straight URL pass-through. There's no magic involved in that whatsoever. If you want to do claims aware with access policies and device reg and so on, that's where you need ADFS behind that and the web app proxy. But otherwise, it can just be a firewall mapping of, hey, it receives and throws it over there. It's incredibly simplistic there. Okay, let's take a look at work folders. And I apologize for people in the room who were in the previous session. You have seen this. Okay, so let's bring up a couple of clients here. And this is kind of what I call the demo list demo, because really there's not much to it, which is a common theme you'll see here. We've tried to make this as easy as we can. So, got two clients here. And you'll see that the documents look the same. These are both configured, connecting to the Works Folders server. And it's really kind of like that magical scenario where let's take a new document, we'll just call it Ticket demo. If I didn't put a camera in there, they wouldn't be dead. And here we go. There's the ticket demo over there. Okay. These are two clients. One of these clients is outside the web app proxy. One of them's inside. So I've published it out. It is a polling service. It is pretty much real time, as you can see. By default, it is wound down to I think something like 30 seconds, something along those lines for sync. So it's not going to kill your server. You wouldn't want a constant connection or a data soak there. I've got this sort of wound down for demo purposes to be really quick. Now, let's go back a step. You've seen how it works. It synchronizes backwards and forwards. Magic. Awesome. But let's take a look at what this actually looks like. So in the 8.1 control panel, we have a new work folders control panel applet. And I'm just going to stop using work folders. And now we've got the out-of-box state. When you click on set up work folders, it again asks for the work email address. I will rephrase, this is the UPN for the user. We're using the term email because that's typically what most users' UPNs actually are. And second of all, most users have no idea what a UPN is. Okay, please enter your UPN. The first thing you're going to do is get a help desk call. What's my UPN? Okay. Now, in a corporate enterprise, we would expect you to do this a group policy so that the users didn't have to do anything. They either come in here and it just works or it's pre-populated with the information for them. Okay, I am logging on as brad@contoso.com. It's going to ask me for my work folders URL. This is all HTTPS traffic. Okay, now as it turns out, I believe, we'll see whether I can remember what this is, 2012 R2 work folders 2, I think. Let's chest this. Yay. And it's going to tell me where it's going to store my folders. Now, you'll notice that the path, you may not be able to see it, I'll tell you, it's in the C users username folder, okay? And under that, we create a work folders folder, exactly like SkyDrive does. So if you think about the way SkyDrive puts that data in that location by default and puts a shortcut up in the favorites and all that kind of thing, same mechanism is happening here. We're done. We hit next. Now, you can enforce policy. So if you are using an MDM scenario, something like an Intune, something like Config Manager, whatever it is that you're using, and it's integrated, you can tick this box. You can say, hey, you must have a PIN code to unlock your machine. You can enforce encryption of the passwords, and you can also erase all the files when you leave the PC. So it's asking me to accept these policies, which I will do. And it's now going to set up. You can see it did a quick sync, and then the files come back down. There's a couple of options here that you can turn on. I don't believe this is enabled yet, so I won't tick it. I've been able to do metered connections. So you saw in the keynote and when Ian was talking about being able to do tethering and being able to do mobile broadband, those kinds of things, you can tick boxes that define whether you are allowed to do that when you're on cellular connections, and if you're in a roaming situation, you probably don't want file syncing unless you've got a really good data plan. So that's the back end. Sorry, that is the client experience. Let me rephrase. If we take a look at the server side of that, under file services, if I go back, come back. All right, under file services, we have a new node called work folders, and we can see all of the configuration. So that share that we talked about, this is just a file share, okay? And when you set one up, when you set up a new sync share, you can either point to existing SMB shares that are already there, or you can just create a new folder, and it will create the folder and share it with all the right permissions. So if we just create a new, let's call it ticket, C shares ticket, it's going to pop up and say it doesn't exist. Do you want to create it? Of course I do. The first thing it's going to ask you is, what does the folder structure look like under that folder? So it's going to create a folder on my file share called C shares ticket, and then under that, for each user that's defined, there will be a folder path. Now, you've got two options. You can use the user alias, which if you've got one domain, they're all going to be unique, no problem whatsoever. But if you've got multiple domains and you've got federation going on and you've got trust going on, you probably want to use the alias at domain mechanism so that you are guaranteed it to be unique. Okay, this is all about making sure that the folder structure that's under that TechEd folder is unique for each user. And it depends on which you use. It makes absolutely no difference to the way it works. This is purely just a configuration option that you choose depending on what's best for your environment. I've got a very simple environment, so I'll just use user alias. You can also turn on the ability to only synchronize a specific subfolder. So if you've got documents that you pre-populate for users, maybe they're templates, maybe they're specific application data files, whatever they might be, you can even specify it down that says only this folder in that structure will actually synchronize between the clients, if that's a scenario that you want. Apparently, it is one that gets asked for a lot because it's in the interface in the preview. You give it a name, hit next, and then it's going to say which users are going to use this work folder. And so I can just do something simple, like domain admins. I think domain users is already checked, so that one won't work. Let's do domain admins. There's a tick box down the bottom that says disable inherited permissions. You probably want this ticked in most scenarios, unless you've got a really good structure. Otherwise, everything's going to flow down. And what happens is when the user comes along, if they don't have full control, the first time they try and log on, they can't create that folder structure in order to be able to continue. So if you don't tick that box, you need to test that your permissions that are coming down are spot on. Otherwise, it won't work. Ticking that box guarantees that it will work. Here's the policies that we have currently. One is the encryption, which enforces EFS encryption at the client level, and also whether you want to integrate with the MDM policies that are in play on that device. That's it. It's going to go through, it's going to run those three little tasks, and we now have an additional share. Now, for each share that's running, you can see the users that have access to that, and you can also take a look at the volume where it's running and see the capacity that you have, and also any quotas that you've enforced. So work folders respects quotas. It's the work folders comes out of the file server team in Windows Server. So everything around dynamic access control, automated rights management, quotas, all the security, everything that comes from a file server flows through into work folders as well. And that's really all there is to it. You've got a client that synchronizes and a server structure at the beginning. There are some architectural decisions that you'll need to make around whether you're going to cluster for high availability, whether you're going to have farms, how you're going to load balance, and all that kind of thing. There are dedicated work folder sessions that you can go to this week to get all of those kind of deep details. That's a great question. So the question was, is this a replacement for CSC, folder redirection? It's built by the same team. And the feedback that I've got from the work folders team is that they see that this will supersede those requirements. Now, in R2, we are only doing a single folder per user. Okay, so each user gets a folder. Whatever's in that folder will synchronize backwards and forwards from the client to the server. If you're using folder redirection in a really complex way, which some people are, or client-side caching in a rather unique way, that may or may not meet your requirements. There's a deep dive on work folders later this week that talks about migrating from CSC and folder redirection into work folders and what's required to do that. It doesn't cleanly layer over the top. It's a set it up and move people to it. But it's moving from an offline files combination of effectively net BIOS SMB traffic backwards and forwards to a genuine synchronization service. And so therefore, there's a lot more we can do at a technical architectural layer of publishing it over HTTPS, being able to make it easy to access, and being very smart about the way things replicate. But it's a good question. All right, so remote access. Really not a lot new here. I'm just going to build this out, because really the only thing that's new in remote access outside the web app proxy that we talked about is the automatic VPNs. And I unfortunately don't have the automatic VPN set up. I got the builds too late to be able to build it. The way this works is there's a group policy that configures an app ID, and it tracks the app ID against the VPN you want, and it's a simple mapping. This app requires that VPN, and you map those out in group policy. That goes down to the client. When the user launches that app, the application gets triggered automatically. Now, this is a new API that's in 8.1, and it has been integrated with the other VPN and providers as well. So the Ciscos, the NetApps, all the other different firewall preventers and VPN providers that are out there, the major ones, are integrating with 8.1 and will become available either at or just after GA. Okay, so there's a lot of integration going on there. Can you repeat the question, sorry? All apps.
Cool.
Yeah, it's basically the app ID says I need to talk back to the branch, and it will trigger the VPN. Now, if you've got seamless VPN configured, it'll just work. If it's two-factor, it'll pop the smart card, RSA token, whatever it is that you need to do to do the second factor. Yep. Okay, unifying the environment. We're going to talk a little bit about single sign-on here and go through. Common identity is a big problem in terms of you want users to access your services on-premises. You've got Windows Azure apps. You've got other platforms out there. You've got SaaS apps. You've got all these things coming along. And from a user perspective, remembering lots of usernames and passwords. From an IT perspective, you really want to be able to control that user's identity and maintain it across multiple environments and be able to leverage federation and so on. So taking a look at the expanded domain join capabilities and matching this up against the new workplace join that we have and comparing and contrasting a little bit. So today you've got a 0-1 scenario. You're either in the domain or you're not. When you're in the domain, you can be fully managed, group policy. You basically give over rights to IT and say, have at it, do whatever you like, there's nothing I can do. If you're not domain joined, the inverse applies. IT can do nothing unless you let them do anything to it. Workplace join is about making the device known to IT. And there were a few tweets that came through after the keynote of, well, it's my device, I'd never register it. That's fine. Don't have access to the resources. It's quite simple. This is about empowering IT to be able to help you work on the device of your choice. But there are always rules and regulations around this. It's not a free-for-all. It's not a, hey, you bought an iPad in, fantastic, put whatever you like on that, and when you leave, just keep it. It's not going to happen. It's not what companies need to happen. It's a give-and-a-get situation. Sure, work on that device of your choice, but there's a toll you need to pay. Just like email on cell phones, and this is the best way to think about it. You want email on your BlackBerry or email on your iPhone? Sure, but you've got to have a PIN lock code on it so that you have to at least in some way authenticate that it is you who's using the phone and not somebody else. Okay? Think of workplace join in the same way. It's about registering your device to say, yes, I want to use my device, and yes, I will allow you to register it so you at least know something about it. Yes, you're going to put a certificate on my device. You may enforce a PIN code. You may enforce encryption of the data that's on the device. That's the price that I have to pay in order to be able to use the device that I want to use. Okay, that's the way to think about it. Now, if you don't want to do that, that's fine. Don't have access to the resources. Use the corporate laptop that we gave you. Have fun. And then domain join is as we know it today. Group policy, full lockdown, BitLocker, all that kind of cool stuff. Do whatever you want. Now, thinking about single sign-on, thinking about identity here, there are four kinds of single sign-on that we think about. The first is browser session-based, and this is available anywhere. Just think about logging on to Live or Hotmail or Outlook.com, whatever it's called these days, and you tick the box that says, remember me. Great, no problem. It will remember you. for the duration of the session cookie. You clear out your cookies, it's gone. And you can log on to any other live site that leverages Passport, and you won't have to re-authenticate because you've got a cookie in your IE that says, here's my ticket to ride, here's my token, I've got a cookie, it's all good, let's go. Then there's seamless two-factor auth for web apps, which is where device registration starts to kick in. One of the byproducts of having your device registered and using single sign-on is that when you launch your first app, you may need to authenticate. Subsequent apps, you will not, because it puts a longer-lasting cookie that has additional tokens in it on your device using that certificate encrypted, combined with your user identity and the device and the cookie. You now get single sign-on to everything. And then there's the desktop single sign-on, which is basically Windows PCs joined to an Active Directory. So just think about each one. When you are not joined, the best you get is a browser-based session. And anybody gets that, because that's kind of easy, right? That's just a browser, there's a cookie, there's a token, you tick the box that says remember me, and you're good to go. No problem. When you workplace join, you get everything except desktop single sign-on. And that's simply because you need to be joined to a domain in order to do that. When you're domain joined, you get all three. And there's a simple way to look at that, and you look at the argument around, I don't want to register my device. That's fine. You either don't get access to resources, or you're going to have to enter your username and password every single time you launch. Your choice. Quite easy. So, Active Directory. There is nothing new in Active Directory. I'll be really open and honest about that. All of the enhancements that we did in 2012 obviously are still there. There are no additional things. This is a slide from Server 2012 launch, nothing different and new here. I see a few of you taking photos. I'm posting the slides, so you're going to get them all. So if you want the slides, you can just take them and download them from the site. I'm not withholding these. They're yours. Now, managing cloud identities and thinking about what we do with all that Active Directory goodness and moving forward, when we give the single sign-on to our users, we need to provide the common access across Windows Server and Active Directory. ADFS is about single sign-on, and it's genuine hybrid identity. The user only has one identity. When you have Active Directory on-premises in Windows Server connected to Active Directory in Windows Azure, that is genuine hybrid identity. When you authenticate against one, your credentials are passed backwards and forwards, and when one gets the credential, it will check with the other and backwards and forwards and all that kind of cool stuff. It's a genuine single sign-on. There's this thing called DirSync, and thinking about that, this is about synchronizing different directories. It's not hybrid identity. It's not one talking to the other. It's, hey, I've got a bunch of metadata here, which is like user data and so on, and we've just announced that we're doing password hash sync as well. That's great. Take all of that information and X-copy it to there, and then disconnect. You now have two separate things in the same state. Active Directory on-premises, Active Directory in Windows Azure. You can authenticate against each one, and that's fantastic. You change the password in one, it will not change the password in the other. You need to run that mechanism on a regular basis or always on or whatever it might be. But the difference between using ADFS and Federation and using DirSync and the new password hash sync is about whether you are replicating between two completely different environments or integrating them together. Which one is the right one for you depends on what you want to do. If you want to effectively copy the core elements of Active Directory around user metadata and the password up to Windows Azure so that you can authenticate it a cloud way but remain disconnected, you do that by using DirSync and the password hash sync. If you want a user to hit Windows Azure AD but check back with on-prem to make sure that it hasn't been disabled in real time and do the kind of registration we talked about, that's what ADFS does. Okay? Just separate those two things in your mind. Two separate entities versus two joined entities. When you log on to Office 365, whether you realize it or not, you are authenticating against Azure Active Directory. Every single user in Office 365 has a Windows Azure Active Directory account. There are about 420,000 unique domains inside Windows Azure Active Directory right now. It goes through something like 9,000 authentications per second across the world. There's about 270 billion authentications that we've done in the last while. And basically, this is also the world's biggest Active Directory. It is Active Directory for the cloud. If you think about some of the biggest Active Directory databases that we've got on-premises, they're coming in around the 50 gig mark in terms of how big the Active Directory DIT file actually is. Windows Azure Active Directory, I can assure you, is magnitudes bigger than that, by a factor of double figures and more. So it is running at an incredible scale. It is running around the world, and it is being leveraged not only for Windows Intune, but more and more cloud providers as we move forward as well with SaaS apps. So it's an exciting space. There's lots going on, and that's why things like ADFS are so important, is as customers look to leverage those kinds of things, they're going to want that hybrid identity. Okay, ADFS. Who in the audience has had the pleasure of using ADFS in its current state? I'm really sorry about that. Just was there a question at the end before I carry on? In Windows Azure AD? So the question was, can you limit where it is within Windows Azure AD in a geographic sense? I actually do have no idea to the answer to that question. I have an equivalent, Nazos, who sits in the Windows Azure team who does Azure AD. If you send me an email, adhall@microsoft.com, I'll find out for you. I honestly have no idea about the internals of AD when Azure AD as to where it replicates to. It may be geo-dispersed. It may not. I'm not sure. Okay. So, where are we? ADFS, yes, sorry, there's way too many of you who have had the pain of going through ADFS in the 2.1 release. So, 2012 R2. I am not the world's most technical person. I'm probably less technical than most of you in the audience. I deployed against a 2012 AD. I updated the schema to R2. I deployed ADFS. I deployed the web application proxy. I configured a claims-aware application. I published it and tested it with multi-factor authentication against Phone Factor in 12 minutes. And I did it manually. That's how hard it is now. Think about 2008 Direct Access moving to 2012. That's how much easier it is now. Okay? It is wizard-driven. It is much easier to configure, and it is much easier to deploy and configure. There's a lot of work being done in ADFS to make it so much easier. So enhancements around the simplified deployment we just covered, around the management of that, it's much easier to use and configure. The web application proxy, you saw how it polled ADFS and just got the list of all the apps, so it makes it super easy to make those available. And then the conditional access, which I'm going to cover in the demo in a sec. The registration, as we talked about, those devices hitting the firewall, going through the web application proxy, they go through ADFS in order to register into AD. The federation still exists there from a B2B point of view. And then the Windows Azure and Office 365 and also the SaaS apps moving forward, the ability to connect with those using ADFS as well. So let's take a look at the new ADFS. So... let's get rid of some VMs here. All right.
Question, right, sir?
Yeah.
Are there file size limits that you would say this is too much? Like Excel documents, Word, that's fine. But then when you start getting into like PST files, it would not be wise.
Are you back on work folders? So you're thinking about synchronizing the data?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So the question was file size. So I think one of the things that we've tried hard not to do is place limits on what you can do. So the default is, I think, a 10 gigabyte file, I should say. Now, you should wind that down to what makes sense for your devices. If you've got users out there with unlimited data plans or really good Wi-Fi connectivity and lots of disk space, do what you like. We don't place restrictions on that. That's over to you to decide. There's no right or wrong answer to that. It all depends on your devices, your connectivity, and your data plans, and the way you want to work. It's all controlled by policy, so you can choose what you want those to be. Now, one thing we do is on devices with limited disk space, things like Windows RT and iOS devices, I need to check with Molly on exactly how this works, but... when we detect that we're on a device under a certain size, we make sure that we can actually replicate the data before we start. And if we don't, there's some sort of algorithm about only bringing down the most recent files or a subset of the files. So there are some smarts that they do under the hood to make sure that you don't try and like bring an ISO image down to a file, a server that doesn't have space. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that. I'm sorry, I can't quite hear you. Oh, is there byte level differencing? Not in R2, no. It is file level, unfortunately. It was almost in. All right. So in ADFS, for those of you who have seen the console before, you'll notice that there is a new authentication policies at the bottom here. And I'll focus on the new things that are in here as well. So in the authentication, one of the first things we configure is some of this that look familiar to you around the extranet and intranet, which types of authentication we're going to allow depending on where you are. And so you can have different authentication mechanisms depending on whether you are inside the corporate network or outside the corporate network. There's also a new tick box down the bottom here that says enable device authentication. This is the workplace join. Okay, so the first tick box when you deploy ADFS, if you want to turn workplace join on and publish it out externally, you need to tick that box, otherwise it doesn't work. It basically says to ADFS, yes, you can accept device registrations. Now, device reg is installed and configured by default in both ADFS and the web application proxy. Other than ticking that box, putting certificates in the right places, and having the right DNS records, that's all you need to do workplace join. You don't need to publish it, you don't need to configure it, it is there by default. Okay? All you got to do is tick the box to say, yes, I want to turn it on. Under multi-factor, here and in the environment that I'm in right here, PhoneFactor is not listed, but if I had installed it, it would be. You can define whether you want multi-factor authentication to be applied to users and groups, which is this top box here. And so I can add a box that says, you know what, Brad's been a naughty boy, so we're going to say that Brad always has to have MFA, always. Or you can turn it off selectively as well. You can also say that multi-factor authentication is only required on unregistered or inversely on registered as well. And you can say that multi-factor auth is only when you're coming in from external. Because if you're sitting in the office, you probably got through some border control in order to get in the door. So you probably have already proved who you are as well as the device you're on. I'll get a question in a moment. Now, if I had installed PhoneFactor here, and I've got like four different environments running, so I apologize, this one doesn't have it. PhoneFactor would be ticked here as well in order to do that. Now, that authentication, those are global settings, and then you can also do it per application as well. So you can set a global precedent which says, by default, this is what's going to happen, unless I come in here and tick different boxes. And then I can tick the box that says, hey, users have to authenticate every time, which would be kind of annoying, and then which multi-factor settings apply to this app. So it is global and then overridden on a per application basis. Okay. Was there a question?
Yes. Did that dialog box actually imply that the Kerberos now available externally?
Is Kerberos available externally? That's a good question. Sam and Uday are doing some deep dives on that. There's some nuances around what hits the web app proxy and how it does translations and passes them on around SAML and Kerberos as well. So that's how it's configured. You'll see the device registration service is there. Again, this is where you would configure with a multi-factor authentication that when I did the workplace join, I just entered my username and password. The reason is that it's just open here. If this particular box here and or here was ticked, then I would have had to do multi-factor authentication. Okay? Yes, Christian, over here. So the device authentication depends on what's in that tick box. So you've got your username and your password is the base level. You've also got device certificates, which I could tick there for certificate authentication. And then you've got the multi-factor authentication if you want to go up to the PhoneFactor, an RSA, or some other service that's going to prompt them for even more. Workplace join is only available in 8.1. Yep, it's an 8.1 capability. Okay, so pretty much that's new ADFS. I wanted to show you the multi-factor auth there. Looking at the time, I've got to keep going. I wanted to show you the fact that you can do all of that per application, and this is all happening at the edge. Okay, bear in mind, web application proxy has two NICs in it, one that faces internal, one that faces external. There are some functions in the web application proxy, and we will publish a list of these on TechNet as we do the doco, that require the web application proxy to be domain joined. there are some scenarios that do require that. Workplace join is one of them. Okay, you cannot do Kerberos to constrained delegation without being a member of the realm in which you're trying to do the constrained delegation to. Workplace join requires that. Okay, so it's one of the scenarios where you do require the web application proxy to be domain joined. There are a couple. Okay, identity management. FIM is what FIM is. FIM is, does what FIM does. We are working on new connectors for Forefront Identity Manager. Things like there is a new connector being developed for Windows Azure AD. There is a new connector for SQL Server Generic, and a generic LDAP connector is coming out. We will continue to build around the outside of Forefront Identity Manager. As we see that FIM is really for complex scenarios that sit around the outside of AD. I'm not going to go through this in too much detail. If you need some detailed FIM information, we'll need to do a separate session on that one. One of the things that FIM does do is provisioning, deprovisioning, and role updates. And I apologize for the logos looking a bit crap. They didn't come across onto the dark background so well. Automating that process of doing all of this and being able to synchronize all of that information across so that when you change a password or metadata, FIM does a really good job of building a metaverse and being able to have all of that information from all the different realms and keeping them in sync across a whole variety of different realms, and also having all the built-in workflow so that if you want to make a change, users can do it either in a self-service way or they can also put it through, and it goes through a routing mechanism of approvals that go with that as well. You should think of FIM as being an add-on to AD more than anything else, as is ADFS and the web application proxy. It's growing that estate around Active Directory. Okay, last section around protecting your data. So bringing your own device in, we've talked about getting access to data. How do you make sure it's okay? How do you protect it? The first thing is that we have the ability to publish access to resources. We've talked about the work folders, and also in Dynamic Access Control of Windows Server 2012, the ability to classify and automatically protect information based on the content. And so in Dynamic Access Control and the on-premises AD and RMS, that means that things like Word, Excel, PowerPoint documents can do content scanning, looking for phrases or strings or regular expressions. Based on that, they can trigger tasks. And one of those tasks is automatic RMS, or if you've got a custom app, you can run a custom task when that text is found. Basically, what happens when you save the document, there is a rule through FSRM that says, oh, I found the string in the document. I better do something about that. What does he want me to do? Oh, if I find that string, I want to apply a rights management template and use this template. Okay? It's all based on triggers. It's all based on content that's been saved on the way through. So publishing out the resources, the multi-factor auth that we've talked about, and also central auditing. Being able to turn on auditing for specific document types, specific users across the enterprise using group policy. You don't have to go and configure it on every single box. You can turn it on centrally, replicates around, and then it starts to do all that kind of logging. Desktop virtualization is really important in these BYD scenarios as well, because if you've got an app that won't run on the platforms that your users are bringing into the environment, they bring in an iPad and you don't have an iPad app. They bring in an Android, you don't have an Android app. A Windows Phone, you don't have a Windows Phone app. How are you going to deal with that? So moving forward, we're building out the remote desktop services. We have the ability to publish out remote apps as well as full desktops if that's required as well. And in the AIP world, this is really a means to an end. You can't get it natively, or inversely, you don't want it to leave the corporate boundary. There might be data that's finance, HR, any kind of sensitive data. You know, you just say to the user, you know what? I'm not going to let you put that on that device. It's simply too highly sensitive or secure, and we don't want that data leaving the corporate data center. The easiest way to get at it is either a remote app or using VDI. The multi-factor authentication we talked about and the phone factor call, this is just a simple diagram to help you understand, if you don't understand how these things work, exactly what happened. So Molly came in and she hit the device reg, which is the application at this point, and it was configured to go up to Windows Azure Active Authentication or Phone Factor. What happens is as it goes across, the application goes out to Phone Factor and says, hey, Molly's dialing in. She needs to be authenticated. What kind of credential prompt do you want? We had it configured with just a simple acknowledge the phone call. You must answer the phone call and you must hit the pound sign. It could be a PIN code, it could be other things. Sarah's in the room from the Phone Factor team. She can help you with the details of exactly what happens. There's mobile phone apps, there's all sorts of different authentication mechanisms that she can use as she comes in. Now, assuming Molly was able to successfully answer that call, it would go back and then say, yep, I got it. You were able to authenticate, and then as you saw, simply by hitting the pound sign, Molly's process carried on with nobody touching anything, because that's the integration that we have there. Now, if Molly had failed to answer the phone call or had not been able to answer it in the correct way, it then goes into the whole sort of common questions that you've already pre-populated and set up. What's your mother's maiden name? What school did you go to? Whatever those questions are. She would have had to answer, and I think it's configurable, but in our scenario, it's three. She has to get three questions right in order to carry on in the absence of being able to do that. I see like there's like three questions, so I will pause for a second. I may call on Sarah. Yes? Is that out of the GAL, Sarah? The user's, the number that, do you want to come up to the microphone? This is Sarah Fender from our Phone Factor team. So she came across with the acquisition and she knows way more about this than I do. The phone number that we called for Molly, where did that come from? Was it configured by Molly or did it come out of like Active Directory GAL? Cool. I think
the
there was.
Portal also handles the secret questions and answers?
It
does.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. There was a question.
Was it caller ID?
I did not know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Was there another question, or was that the second question? Oh, the question over there?
So, on the Phone Factor stuff, any plans for integration with BIM, having the Phone Factor QA gate, be able to integrate with your original questions in the BIM self serve pattern reset?
Short answer is no. Acknowledged. Thank you for the feedback. All right. Thank you, Sarah. So Sarah's going to be around during the week as well and down in the marketplace a little bit. So if you've got Phone Factor questions, Tara is your lady to talk to. She's the expert over there. I will delegate to her in all cases. There's also the ability to configure this in the time frame that we talked about as well, the frequency of how we do that. So you might not want to do an MFA on every single instance for some data, or maybe some of those publishings you do want to do every time. So think about how often the user is going to have to do that. Now, let's see. Did anyone not see it in the keynote? Because if you've already seen it, you don't want to see it again, I won't do it again. Did anyone not see the demo in the keynote with Phone Factor? You all saw it? All right, I'm not going to do it again then because you kind of saw it this morning unless you really want to see it again. All right, anybody want to see it again? No, we're good. Awesome. Dynamic Access Control. Has anyone used Dynamic Access Control? Played with it in a lab, configured it at all? Who's heard of Dynamic Access Control? All right, at least half the room's even heard of it. So, Dynamic Access Control is from the Windows Server file team, just like Work Folders is. And Dynamic Access Control was new in 2012, and it was about tagging, bagging, and classifying information. So we automatically classify and identify information. So that content scanning engine that we talked about, you save a document onto a file server somewhere, Dynamic Access Control is turned on, it's going to catalog that information and see if it's got a policy that requires it to be tagged, which is basically a piece of metadata that's attached to the file, and then depending on what that classification is, there may be a rule associated with it. And so, for example, you might have a catchphrase, confidential, classification, whatever word you want. Let's just use confidential. If a document contains the word confidential, it may classify it as a sensitive piece of information, so high HBI, whatever you want to call it. Based on that classification, the task might say, any document that is classified as HBI, I want you to apply a rights management template to it. And so the scenario here, we do a lot of work, obviously, on this content before it becomes public. We've been sort of working on this for the last few months, and we get to release it out. All of our documents that we've been working on for the last sort of 3 or 4 months as we built this out, both from an engineering and from a slide and content and TechNet point of view, has tags in it. And based on that tags, it's automatically rights protected, both in our SharePoint sites and on our file servers as well. And so it's pretty hard for this information to accidentally, quote unquote, slip out, because it means that you've got to somehow get a copy of the document that's unencrypted. And in order to do that, it means you're the person that created it. So it's actually pretty simple to work out how some of this information leaks, because quite frankly, it comes from the person who wrote it. Beg your pardon? We integrate with third-party DLP. So we have built-in capability to do rights management. There is also a custom task that says, I'd like to run something else. So if that DLP can be triggered in some way, shape, or form in an automated fashion, command line, a script, some sort of API, then you can integrate with it, yes. It's purely based on an integration with with DAC to say, I've got a custom task, and it's over there. Question over there. So if a user moves the file, so it depends on what you mean by that. The classification is actually metadata on the file itself. Okay, so if you move that to a location that knows about that metadata, you're okay. But again, as with the previous message, if you take that document and put it on a USB, a FAT32 USB, it's going to lose that metadata on the way out, which is that's where the classification is kind of useful, but the actual encryption is the thing that protects the data. But if you move it around the environment outside of places that know about this, then yes, you're going to lose that. Yeah, this isn't just sort of a one tick box and magic happens everywhere in the environment. You've actually got to think about your whole environment, all of your information. Where's it going to go? How's it going to be protected? And how are you going to do that tracking? No, it doesn't. Sorry, does it have an alert? No, it does not. You can send what you can do is send a message on certain events, so therefore you would be able to track it that way. Yeah. There's the automatic classification, goes through. Was there a question? Someone yelling? No, domain. And Windows Server 2012 and Windows 8. So the BYOD scenario pretty much is through work folders. Okay, so the data that is stored in work folders, it has dynamic access control because it's at the Windows server level. Okay, that's pretty much the only way to get any kind of classification going with a BYOD device, simply because it could be an iPad and who knows what's on that, right? Centrally managed, all of this configuration is in Active Directory. It is all passed through by group policy, so it's all nice and central. Rights management, we've talked about the integration there. And then there's also all of the processing and so on. It all pretty much happens in real time. There's no way to wind it down, but basically it's on. It is triggered by an NTFS write, okay? And it will not apply against a locked file, i.e. one that is open. So if the file is open, it will be triggered in terms of it's going to finish. It's going to wait for the file to be closed before it can finish the task, okay? And I'm not going to have time to do that because I am completely out of time. Dynamic access control is actually available as a lab. Okay, there's a hands-on lab here if you want to go through and configure it and see it for yourself. That lab is available online as well as in the hands-on lab here area as well. Quick recap, all the things we've gone through. Registration, enrollment, we've been through the internal application access through app VPNs, the corporate resources, identity, and then all of the new stuff around web app proxy, work folders, ADFS, and so on. So I apologize for running right up to 6 o'clock and standing between you and free beer in the company marketplace. I'm going to be down at the booth. If you have more questions, please come see me at the booth, and we'll have a beer and talk about it. Thank you.